We are going to head to the great state of Maine. It's time for the Media Beat live from Maine with David Terachuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. His own website, themediabeat.us, is always chock full of information and opinions. And we get the same on Friday mornings. Good morning, David.
Well, good to be with you. And I'm joining the insightful Marshall Miles, not from the media capital of the world, New York City, but, as you say, from the great state of Maine.
And how is the weather there this morning?
Well, at this precise moment, it's very wet and cool, but I think it's going to warm up and get fresher. Warm in a fresh kind of way, which will be a great relief after some really hot and sticky time in New York City lately.
What's interesting is I moved to Maine years and years and years ago, and I moved in late spring and in the summertime, and I was talking to people who live there. I said, you know, people have been talking about Maine. It's this and that, and this has been beautiful. And they said, wait till September 1st. It feels like the whole state moves 800 miles to the north.
That's true. And what is undeniable about Maine, while the summers are indeed tremendously easeful in lots of ways. Boy, do they have long winters.
Yeah, but they know how to handle it up there. They really do.
The road crews
and everything like
every
that.
Every year, you do get very used to it.
Yeah.
But even here, there's some an awareness of global warming having its impact. The winter can sometimes have a very destructive effect on the roads. And recently, that's not been caught so much. I'm not going to say that a Maine winter is ever quite mild, but it's certainly not as severe as they used to be.
Well, nothing is as severe as it used to be.
So true. We are now living the predictions that so many of us were making, and publicizing the predictions of scientists about the coming crisis of climate change, and now those changes are taking place in front of our very eyes.
You know, it's interesting you say that because it's so apparent now that that climate change it has actually evolved into a real-time situation, and maybe it wasn't as first envisioned by people who talked about it, but it definitely has brought about whatever weather patterns we have are stronger, are more intense, and more frequent. And, you know, years ago when people talked about climate change, a lot of scientists said, you know, this is going to mean for a very dry West, and also if you live in the Northeast, your winters are going to be a little different, but you don't have to worry about moisture. You're going to have a lot of it. And you kind of look at that, and you don't hear the climate change people bashers anymore because it's evolving right before our eyes.
Yeah, I guess it's a little like the frog in the pot of boiling water analogy. When it's happening in its first stages, you just don't notice the gradual changes. But once the change picks up some pace, it becomes very clear and undeniable. Though, of course, we do still have climate change deniers. I think we were saying this a couple of weeks ago when I was reflecting on my time with the United Nations, but I can go back even further than that, which was about 25 years ago. Longer ago than that, back in the 1980s, colleagues of mine in British television were making documentaries that predicted on the basis of information coming out of what was known as the Club of Rome, lots of international comparisons being made and predictions looking forward, that back in the 1980s, these documentaries were making it very clear that the very things that are now happening would be happening. Though it has to be said that, you know, the caveat voiced at the time was this will be a gradual change. But of course, 30, 40 years later, the graduality of that, if that's the correct noun for it, has picked up pace enormously and is not exactly a race now, but it's certainly fast changing the situation as, in real time, as you said.
Well, when you mentioned that events will happen gradually, when people think about things that are happening on the Earth and the atmosphere, people think, oh, okay, that's hundreds of years. But just yesterday alone, Greenland lost, this is another part of the story, 8.5 billion tons of surface mass, that is ice, were lost yesterday alone. That's a staggering amount.
You know? Yes, often the statistics are extraordinary. And of course, the other symptomatic events, of course, are flash floods and massive downpours. Those regions of China, which were so badly affected over the last week, got something like a whole year's supply of rain in less than 3 days. That's quite extraordinary concentration of precipitation.
Well, we'll move on from climate change to once again COVID, and the variant in this country is just getting underway. It's interesting because I was talking earlier this morning, somebody saying, "Well, look at what's happened in Great Britain, how it's now dropping off," and the difference between the United States and even in countries like China, the huge countries. If you look at the United States, the Northeast does pretty well in dealing with this. The Southeast and into the middle portion of our, the Midwest, not doing so well with the new variant outbreak. Scientists are now thinking that the variant will be stronger, but then won't last as long. But when you look at the United States and you look at the rest of the world, you can't compare them because landmass and what people do, and especially in the United States, is so wide and varied from the areas you go to. You know, I don't know how people expect the United States in this country to deal with this because there's so many distinct regions that people want to do what they want to do.
Sure, and President Biden is, of course, where the buck stops when it comes to taking hold of what is clearly a nationwide problem with enormous regional variations. You inevitably look to the top man, the top individual, the top authority. Sure enough, the president has stepped forward over the last 24 hours. And although stopping short of using the word mandate, is now doing, of course, his level best to create an ever-increasing momentum for vaccines as mandatory, if not in word, in certainly indeed. If it's not mandatory, it's as near mandatory as makes no difference. All the emphasis now on the need to get vaccinations, and now of course in many jurisdictions, not just the national, but in the in states and other jurisdictions, we're trying to ensure that. Excuse me, sorry, just an interruption from the side here. I was trying to explain that that while we all look to the presidency for leadership in this matter, the president is finally after some considerable pause for thought about all this, acknowledging what the information that the CDC has obviously been feeding him over the last week or so, and which has been revealed, interestingly, by what I guess you would call a leak from the CDC of a 25-page document of the CDC that has been published in the Washington Post, though I think perhaps leak is the wrong word, because it has all the hallmarks of a strategic kind of leak, a leak that the authorities at the CDC won't be too unhappy about, because its language being used internally at the CDC essentially says that, to take a direct quote from it, the war has changed. The war against COVID is on a completely different footing. In fact, it's a different kind of war entirely, because the virus itself has changed. The The variant, I mean, all that means, of course, is a change. The Delta variant with the name Delta, is operating in a completely different way. And therefore, authorities' reaction to it needs to be different, too. Inevitably, it's been politicized, and political criticism from the Republican side is saying that Democrats in leadership are flip-flopping and waffling. That's one way of putting it, I suppose, but a highly politicized way of putting it. And what's becoming very clear is that new measures are needed, or at least an increase of the growing momentum for vaccination is all that more important, because we actually are dealing with a very different kind of enemy, and that's what that's exactly what the president was trying to say in his statement to the nation, and what other jurisdictions, right down to counties in those badly affected states that you were talking about, where things are just not looking so great at all, with very low vaccination rate, plus extraordinary surge in the Delta infection rate itself in states like Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama, it's very clear that some new measures are needed, tighter measures. Whether or not they become actual imposition by law is still, because America is so different and so determined to make things a matter of personal choice, even when huge matters of importance like public health and very survival of individuals is at stake. What seems to be happening now is the drumbeat for vaccination in a way that it might as well be mandatory. The amount of pressure that's being applied to make it happen is probably the only course forward.
It's interesting. I think the moves that have been made, not only by the president, where if you work for the government, you're not going to be forced to get vaccinated. But if you don't want to get vaccinated and you want to go to your job, at least twice a week, you're going to have to get tested. And testing doesn't cost anything. But that is a great way to take a huge part of the workforce in this country, people that work for the United States government, there's a lot of them, and bring that under control. But I'm finally glad that private businesses, which do have the right to do certain things, are finally stepping forward, big businesses, and saying, listen, if you want to come to work, you're going to have to get vaccinated. If you want to have your job, you're going to have to get vaccinated.
On the gradation between carrot and stick, it's clearly getting more towards the stick than the carrot. Though, of course, some carrots are being encouraged, too. The president himself was suggesting that, rather like New York City is already doing, you get a certain reward for getting a vaccination, $100, in fact, in the case of New York City. And I think the president was suggesting it for other jurisdictions as a possibility as well. The whole gradation now is moving definitely towards the mandatory end of the scale, the stick end rather than the carrot end. And again, it's because we are dealing with a different kind of enemy now.
Well, in Massachusetts, just yesterday, they announced their lottery winners for getting COVID. Will you put your name in? One guy who's, I think, 35 or 40 years old, won $1 million. And a teenager who was 17 got a $300,000 scholarship grant. And as great as that sounds, it's a little absurd where you have to give away $1 million or $300,000 to get somebody vaccinated.
We're dealing with a difficult problem. The American tradition, I suppose you can call it, of individual liberties. It takes on a really disturbing form sometimes, and when it cuts against an even more vital principle, I think, of keeping us all safe and healthy, then you really have a big problem. But and it seems extraordinary on the face of it that we have to bring out measures like offering the chance, at least, of a winnings in the millions of dollars for people to do something which you would think was just plain common sense. But that there we are. We're dealing with one aspect of American exceptionalism, which can show up sometimes, as now, in something that's a little bit freakish, but necessary in the circumstances, it seems.
I guess I would rather live with that than if people haven't heard. In Australia, in Sydney, they have now deployed the military to ensure the COVID lockdown goes in place. So I guess I'd much rather give away $1 million than have the military have to come out in the streets. And that is something that would not be good in this country at this time.
No, I think you'd see the pushback. If we're disturbed by the kind of so-called hesitancy and pushback against vaccination and pushback against public health policy in general and science in general in some ways, that's bad enough. But I think if the military were deployed, or indeed, I think that it's been made very clear that this administration is very sensitive in this point, and probably sensibly so, too. The idea of, while the federal government, the biggest employer in the country, in fact, is now putting such a hefty emphasis on its employees getting vaccinated and making life a little uncomfortable, in fact, if individuals don't opt for vaccination, having to wear masks indoors and taking once weekly or even twice weekly tests. The same is not being bruited for the for instance, that would be the case with federal employees in the Department of Defense, for instance. Active duty troops, who number even more in total than the almost a million civilian members of the Department of Defense, who do come under this new emphasis and indeed instruction, really, in many senses, to get vaccinated. That same obligation is not going to apply to active service troops, who a number of something like 1.3 million. And I think if the troops were ordered, as a matter of military order, to get vaccinated. The administration seems very attuned to the notion that that would not be welcomed, and as I say, as part of the great American tradition of individual liberties, that would sit very badly with an awful lot of people, not just military men and women. But so far, at least, the administration is being very leery about moving in that direction. Though if they did it, that would be a massive sign, I think, a massive indication, a massive message of the seriousness of the situation we're in.
I think what's being discussed from the last report that I saw, and this was either out of Reuters or the BBC, is that what the military is thinking of doing is anybody, when you join the military and you're accepted in, you go through getting just an amazing amount of shots and stuff like that. I think what they're planning on doing is, if you're going to join the military and anybody new joining in, the COVID vaccination will be included in those shots. I think that is what they're trying to put together from the two stories that I heard and saw.
But Biden has instructed the Defense Department to make a study of this whole matter, yeah. And of course that's one of the considerations that will inevitably be part of that study. Traditionally, what's been the argument behind that, of course, is that when they're on active duty, when you're in active service, because America's position in the world where that happens is, of course, overseas, where people are vulnerable to many diseases that for which vaccinations exist, and of course it makes total sense for that to apply to anybody who's likely to be sent overseas. And the interesting thing now is whether we are prepared to make that leap to saying that if you're in service, giving your service to the nation in military form, even on the home front, The home front has become such a dangerous place now that you need, by force of order, to have the vaccination while you're serving within the 48 contiguous states as well.
And with the military, the great thing about the military is the Joint Chiefs get together. They will study. They will recommend. To the head, the civilian leader of the Defense Department, and that person can either try to institute those changes or not. So it'll be interesting to see what the military does. But before we go, a couple of the things that I want to get your opinion on. It didn't take long for China to start meeting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I think the Chinese are going to have, just like every other big country that has forged their way into Afghanistan, whether it was Russia, whether it was the Soviet Republic or the United States, dealing with one particular group, be it the Taliban or whatever, Afghanistan is the type of country where other countries just can't have the same effect that they have when they set up rules and regulations with smaller countries, because Afghanistan is just such a wild, wild west of different leaders and throughout the landscape.
Well, I'm sure the Chinese, like they do in every continent now, where they're trying to exert influence, and it is every continent now. I've a considerable personal experience of the way they set about it in Africa. But yes, in South Asia, Afghanistan in particular now, they are intent, as they are everywhere else, in exerting as much influence as they can. They believe themselves to be, and this makes total sense, since they are now the second most powerful economy in the world, they want to have diplomatic and policy influence commensurate with that. But as you say, Afghanistan's a difficult territory to try and exert influence over. You mentioned the Soviet Union's efforts to gain a hold over Afghanistan. That did not do too well. It became known as the Soviet Union's Vietnam. And this, of course, goes way back. I happened to be yesterday looking at a very thick volume, which is all about. It's called The Great Game, which is the phrase used in the latter part of the 19th century for the conflict then between two major powers at that point in history, which was Victorian Britain on the one hand, and guess who? Tsarist Russia on the other, to gain influence in Afghanistan and ultimately all of the Indian subcontinent as well. So it's a tricky place to attempt to get influence, and I don't think the Chinese are necessarily going to find it any easier than any other previous big power.
And I want to go to finally this morning, and that is moving on to Hong Kong, where the first person to be jailed under their new security law has been given 9 years in jail.
Sure. The new security laws are exactly what was feared when Britain made its agreement with mainland China to hand over on a time frame Hong Kong into the arms of the communist Chinese administration. And the agreement was that it would be a gradual process, and in the meantime, over 50 years or so, or 40 certainly, there would be an operation, a system which is described as a one nation, two systems, the capitalist ethos of Hong Kong itself, the city-state, would be allowed to continue. And of course, that's essentially been torn into tatters now. Mainland China is exerting as much force as it possibly can, though I guess it could even get better, get further and worse. And at the moment, as you say, it's playing out on the ground as people being sent to jail for their beliefs and their political actions, their exercise of what were traditional political liberties under the British. Although I'm not going to say that the British was a totally open democracy either when it controlled Hong Kong. but it certainly has, within the confines of Hong Kong itself, been possible for you to exercise political dissent, and that's certainly not on the cards anymore now that mainland China has cracked down so firmly as it has on Hong Kong.
And final comment, I saw a very interesting piece of video this morning out of West Virginia. The governor of West Virginia, by the way, Governor Justice, gave a speech to his constituents, basically lambasting them for allowing the COVID-19 variant to take over. And I just thought it was great. He was there with a jacket, an open collar shirt, and basically talking in plain English by saying, "Hey, listen, you know, our rate is going up. We were at one point leading the country in the percentage of vaccinations. We're now 35th. We've got to get ourselves back in order here." It was just I want people to Google it and take a look at the way he spoke, because West Virginia is no way can be considered anything but a red state. And he put a forceful speech in common English out to his people. I just want to see how they react to it, the constituents react to it.
Sure, the red state leadership in many ways, it's fragmented, of course. It's not monolithic by any stretch of the imagination. But yes, more and more Republicans are in positions of leadership, at least are seeing what I guess, in cold, rational terms, would appear to be the logical thing to do. Urge people to get vaccinations. So the drumbeat I was talking about earlier on is getting louder and louder, and even embracing the people who you might imagine would be the last people to come on board.
Now, I didn't ask you earlier. I guess I should have. Does the call to the Post come up today, or no notification?
Well, what I've been observing about journalism this week is that a lot of people doing good work, and at the same time, I haven't seen anything egregiously bad either. I think what we've got is the pulse of the nation's media ticking over rather healthily, I'm glad to say, in the face of an awful lot of stuff that concerns ill health. And it's good to see journalism generally doing a good job.
And I just love the one quote that I heard someone give on C-SPAN, and that people were calling up and saying, the scientists got it wrong, they're flip-flopping, they're doing this, they're doing that. And I forget who it was who called in and said, what you don't understand is that viruses change. Science doesn't.
So the very fact that the heart of this issue, yes.
Yeah. Science doesn't change. Science only can react to what it sees, and then when it sees something different, it has to react to that. Science doesn't change. Viruses change. That's the history of viruses.
Absolutely. So we're dealing with what the CDC is saying internally, at least, a changed war, because we have a changed enemy.
Well, how long are you up there in the beautiful great state of Maine?
Probably going to be here for 4 weeks now. So we'll be talking again from the great state of Maine.
Well, enjoy the next 3.5 to 4 weeks, David, and we'll speak to you next week.
You will.
Take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. And, of course, here at robinhoodradio.com, click on demand, click on David Tarachuk with The Media Beat.